I want to call out the word salespeople. Everybody is a salesperson. Yes, there are salespeople who are salespeople by trade, but if you are selling your ideas at work, if you are selling your children on eating their broccoli, if you are selling your friends on where to go out to dinner, you are selling. We're talking about leading and teaching and inspiring and motivating and a whole bunch of other things.
We have found that these great sellers, these great leaders, these great people, they create a sense of agency in the people they're talking to so that the people that they're leading want to work for them, want to fight for them, not have to fight for them or have to work for them. Their customers feel like they are part of the decision-making process. Who are you going to show up as? You're going to show up as the person that you think they're expecting or the person that they hope you are. People really love when they see themselves in you. And if you want that, you sort of have to be the person that they hope you are, not the person they expect you to be.
I'm Erica Kohlberg, and you're listening to the Erica Taught Me podcast. Have any of you read that book, Atomic Habits? I read it years ago and loved it. So the author, James Clear, was always on my dream list of people to interview on this podcast. When the opportunity to interview him finally came a few months ago, it had to be recorded remotely. And if you're a regular follower, you know that I don't often do remote interviews. I immediately started researching, trying to find the best possible tool available, and the one name that came up consistently was Riverside. If you don't already know, Riverside is a platform specifically designed for high-quality remote video and audio recording, and it's good for anyone who needs reliable recordings of remote conversations. What I loved about using it is that it puts users first. For example, it records audio and video locally on each person's device, which means better quality, even with varying internet connection. One less thing to worry about when it comes to editing. Speaking of which, their editing tools make post-production a breeze, with features like animated captions and text overlays. When you're editing, you get instant feedback on exactly how your changes impact the overall look and feel of the project. You can also upload content into Riverside and leverage their super easy editing features, such as their text-based editor and automatic clip generation. By the way, if you want to watch or listen to the James Clear episode, you definitely should to see how it turned out when I used Riverside. It's episode number 65. Right now, you can try Riverside for free, and when you purchase a plan, you can get 15% off with code Erica. Just go to erica.com/riverside. Remember, Erica is always with a K. That's erica.com/riverside. I'll put the link in the show notes so you can try it for free.
So what do you think is the difference between excellent salespeople versus mediocre salespeople?
Before Colin answers that question, I want to call out the word salespeople that you mentioned, because it's important to note that everybody is a salesperson. Like, I want to make sure that if we're going to dive in and start this interview talking about selling, that you realize that anybody listening sells. Mm-hmm. Yes, there are salespeople who are salespeople by trade, but if you are selling your ideas at work, if you are selling your children on eating their broccoli, if you are selling your friends on where to go out to dinner, you are selling. So all of the stuff that we're going to talk about for the next however long, when we talk about selling, we're talking about leading and teaching and inspiring and motivating and a whole bunch of other things. So I don't want to turn anybody off right at the beginning where they're like, oh, we're talking about salesperson. We're talking about you, dear listener. So I know you wanted to answer, but I wanted to get that out there before we did that.
That's a great answer. To piggyback on that, we say it often that everyone is either selling themselves, selling an idea, or selling someone else's idea, and that's okay. And what we found is that the difference between those who are selling at a high level and those that are trying to figure it out is that, like, they're not self-confident, they're self-aware. So, like, they're talking to someone, they know in real time, I realize that this person is not listening to me. They're waiting to speak, and they can course correct in real time. Or they realize, oh, this person, as I'm talking to them, doesn't understand what I'm trying to say. Like, they think that I am trying to sell them, and really, like, I'm asking them a question I actually want to know the answers to. Or they think I'm trying to extract value, and in actuality, like, I'm not. I am trying to add value. So these people are just really self-aware, really self-confident. To answer your question directly, like, what's the difference? The difference is, like, great salespeople are the exact opposite of who people think they are. Mm-hmm. And so they show up that way. And we'll ask them, like, what do you think of when you hear the word salesperson?
I also was thinking about sales as in everyone is a seller.
Yeah.
Like I distinctly remember when I was in college, I met the first lawyer of my life. I didn't know any lawyers growing up. And I asked him what the most important skill set was. And he said to be a good communicator. And Warren Buffett also says, be a good communicator. That's the most important skill. But I actually think one level up to be the best skill set anyone can have if you want to get rich is to be a good salesperson, be good at selling. Because that means not only are you a good communicator, but you are self-aware and you're persuasive in the way that you communicate.
Yeah.
Right?
So take that a step further then. Because that's it. So imagine like you're talking to someone and you realize you said something and it didn't land. What do you do? Do you just continue to move on or do you just acknowledge it? You know what? That did not land and I'm able to course correct in real time and make sure that I acknowledge it. Or when someone's listening to you and they're like, ah, I actually think this person's waiting to speak. Like, how do you adapt in real time? Like there's like this, we talk about pathological optimism a lot as like this, this core theme across great salespeople. It's not because they're naive. It's just because they know what a conversation sounds like when you don't need something from someone. Like imagine if you already thought the person was on your team, already was your partner, already was a customer, how real would you be with them? So succinctly put, I think that the greatest sellers on the planet are showing pieces of themselves most people have been taught to hide since their, you know, professional career took off. And we're just trying to get back to people like themselves. So why not show someone you're imperfect ASAP? So that you can vibe.
Yeah. What is pathological optimism?
Pathological optimism is a characteristic trait that we have found across really great leaders, really great sellers, really great influential people. It's where someone truly believes in the upside of the conversation, of the outcome. So like an example would be me and you were having a today, South By. So pathological optimism is we believe that this room is going to be full, right? We believe that the value in our product is going to be immense. And so then we come from a place of optimism, not because we're naive, but because we actually believe in what we're saying. And so we're able to have that conversation so that when someone's talking to you, they're not thinking, huh, I feel like I'm being manipulated. I feel like I'm being sold to, as opposed to, why does this person continue to see the good in me when I'm not looking for it, right? Or yeah, believe in the opportunity.
And you talk about good salespeople and good selling, and there's this weird thing that happens, and we see it all the time, especially we're like, we teach a class called Sales Mindset for Entrepreneurs at USC. So we get to see these college students who are going out into their first job. And as leaders, as sales leaders, as coaches, we've seen salespeople. And anytime people get into a selling situation, they like become this person that they aren't. Mm-hmm. They want to be this person that they're not supposed to. They think I have to put on this particular act to be a salesperson. I have to know exactly what I'm talking about. I have to sound a certain way. Mm-hmm. I have to be an extrovert, even if I'm not. And the reality is great sellers, they throw those rules, quote unquote, out the window. Like they know that they can use their own strengths, whatever they may be, as Colin said, to be able to have a meaningful conversation, connect with somebody, and teach them something that is going to allow them to make a decision that's good for them.
One of the things that you were both saying is that you have to be quite self-aware and you have to know whether your messaging is hitting right. Mm-hmm. So how can you tell whether your messaging is hitting right and you have to course correct?
It's different for everybody in a weird way. We have this rule that we talk about in class often, which is if you think you sound cheesy, you're right. You sound cheesy. Or if you think you sound like you're being pushy or salesy, you're right. Like we all have that inner compass where we're like, you know what? This just feels like it's not landing right now. The greats are just better at listening to that. And we found that you can teach it and you can start to learn it as you start to look for it and label it. But in general, we all have that voice in our head where it's like, you know what? This story I'm telling right now is rambling a little bit. And you're right. Your story's probably rambling if you're thinking that. So it's that self-awareness element. That,
like the first 5 minutes of this podcast.
When you were talking?
Yeah. We ask this question often, you know, what do you think of when you hear the word salesperson? And people will say manipulative, smarmy, yucky, lying, like we just happened. And then we'll say, the next question, which is, well, who's the greatest salesperson you can think of? And the top two answers are Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Steve Jobs. And the close third are people's partners and people's kids. And you think about that incongruence. Like, how is it that you just said yucky when we asked you what you thought of when you heard the word salesperson. And then you talk about someone you revere and you admire when we ask you who the greatest salesperson is that you can think of. So there's this amazing incongruence that we live in. Like the antithesis of great salespeople are great salespeople. And so we just, you know, we need people to see themselves in that, because you can't change the world. You can't change anybody's world if you don't know how to move people.
Yeah.
And that's why we started teaching, I think, right? Like it was like, we were seeing these new entrants into the workforce. They didn't know how to move people. They couldn't chase their dreams. They couldn't ask for promotions. They couldn't ask for projects. They couldn't even like raise their hand and say, this is what I want to do in 3 years. And so we were like, okay, let's teach the class that we wish other people were teaching right now. And then the book came out of that.
I just think we need to reframe salespeople. Like if salespeople have this negative association with it, then you need to call it persuasion, or you need to call it the art of aligning people with your vision.
That's exactly right. Most people that we talked to as we were writing the book, and we can get into that a little bit as far as, you know, we thought we were going to be writing a book about the greatest salespeople on the planet and how they thought and how they approached selling. And what ended up happening was we would ask these questions that Colin just asked, and we would ask the people we were interviewing. We would say, who's the greatest salesperson you know? And so we started out with down the line, real, you know, professional salespeople. And they were giving us answers immediately of people who did not have sales in their title. It would be, you know, artists or the cupcake shop owner in their hometown or who knows what. But we would ask if we could talk to these people. And so then we would start having conversations with non-salespeople and ask them about the quote unquote selling that they do every day. And they all sounded the same. It was crazy. Like it didn't matter if we were talking to the number one salesperson at Adobe or an artist who's world renowned for her feminist paintings and was nervous about going to an art opening in Germany because she had to sell paintings. Like they were saying the same things. And so those became the buckets that we write about in the book and that we teach about. The most interesting thing was it didn't matter what walk of life you came from, the greats, the successful ones still approached it in exactly the same way.
Yeah, there's like a sense of agency that is so hard. Yeah, like a lot of times early in your career, you think you're supposed to know it all.
Yeah.
And then at some point you realize, damn, like people don't like being in a room with know-it-alls. And then all of a sudden you're like, well, wait a minute, like, have I been lost this whole time? Like I thought I was supposed to be a knower, and now I'm realizing that people want me to be a learner, and I have to authentically be a learner. Like you have to actually ask questions that you really want to know the answers to. Like that's a very hard transition from someone who's been trained their entire life to act like someone they're not, and then to get permission. So like this sense of agency is what we found is just a huge through line across great salespeople, that when you realize people will say no to you because you're right. Like when you realize that people will say no to you because you have the answers, when people are like, ah, I don't feel like I'm part of this decision. Like, I don't feel like you need me or you value me. So like, why would I say yes if you don't even need me in the process? Like we have found that these great sellers, these great leaders, these great people, like they create a sense of agency in the people they're talking to, so that the people that they're leading want to work for them, want to fight for them, not have to fight for them or have to work for them. Their customers feel like they are part of the decision-making process. Like, it's really hard to ask someone a question I never heard before. Like that's like we wrote the book. We were like, hey, why are great sellers asking questions that no one else is asking? It's not because they're asking leading questions. It's because they're thinking about these people differently. Like in their head, the conversations they're having with themselves are different than most people. You come out and you ask someone a question you've never heard before, you will ideate for the first time in real time on that answer. Like whatever that answer is, that's your answer. Like you own that. Like someone didn't sell you on that answer. Like you take ownership. If I never saw you again, I gave you a gift by asking you a question that you never heard of before. Like these great leaders, sellers, people are masters at creating a sense of agency in the people that they are selling to.
So give me an example of that kind of question you can ask that someone has never been asked before.
We call them impactful questions. Yeah. And like Colin said, it's these questions that add value. They are generally never yes or no questions. They're always open-ended. And if you think about a selling situation, like let's talk about a typical selling situation, you're usually extracting value when you're asking questions. What's your budget? Tell me your budget. What's your timeline? You know, tell me the, and it's stuff that people know and they know why you're asking it. But all of these greats, they come in and they ask these impactful questions that do this adding of value. So there's a million different ones in our, and we have a lot of fun in our class every semester. We'll trade them. We'll be like, okay, you guys think of an impactful question and tell us, and then we'll give you one of our favorites because we literally collect them like gold. And so it could be anything. Colin's favorite is just something like, what rules should we be breaking?
I love that.
Which is a great question, because you never really think about things in that context. Like, yeah, there are rules that we have in whatever context we're thinking of that maybe we don't actually need to stick to every time. We do an interviewing session with our students because a lot of them want to either interview people to join their startups or get interviewed so that they can join a company of their own. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everybody at the end of an interview is going to say, oh, what, you know, do you have any questions for me? And they're going to hear the same questions all the time. And one of those questions is always going to be, what does it take to succeed in this role? Which is a fine question, but the interviewer has been asked that question 1,000 times if they interview enough people. To make that an impactful question, it could be as simple as just putting some constraints on it and saying, of the 3 people who have been most successful in this role, what is something that they all had in common? That person's never thought about it in that context before. They've never said, let me actually go back and think of specific individuals and what they had in common, as opposed to the textbook answer that I have here, which is, you know, coachability and thriving in a crazy environment and all the other things that they have. So it's not easy, but it is simple to change a non-impactful question into an impactful question.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, we have a lot of them. Like, one of my favorites is, like, if you could only spend resources on one problem that you're currently facing, like, what would it be? Like, we have so many problems that we're facing. Like, you want me to isolate that? Like, let me think about that. But whatever that answer is, once again, that's my answer, not your answer. And if you, like, all of a sudden the internet broke and we left, that's your answer. Like, for the rest of your life, like, I gave you, it's such a rare breed of people that you could ask questions that add value.
Yeah. Like,
most people are just sucking it out of you. And I want to say that they're not leading questions. Like, why they're special isn't because they're asking impactful questions. Like, they're special because they want to know the answers to the questions that most people don't. That's
the
why
key.
They're special.
Yeah. You can't ask an impactful question that you don't actually want to know the answer to. So going back to your first question about what makes a great seller, like, they genuinely want to know the answers to the questions they ask. Mm-hmm. They find a way and different ways to get into the headspace where they're like, I need to know more about this person. I want to dig into the problem that I might be able to help them solve. I want to dig into other things just to get to know them individually. That caring of what the answer is separates the person who's just reading from a script and going through the motions and having a conversation with 30 people every day from the person who gets to have a conversation with people that they are genuinely excited about learning more about.
So I'd love to go through these different scenarios where it is very important to be good at selling, whether selling yourself, selling a vision, whatever it is. And I think the one that applies to the most number of people listening is that interview situation. Mm-hmm. So what else can you tell me about how to succeed in an interview by being a better seller?
Yeah, that's a really good question. That might be an impactful question.
The first thing I would do is know that if you are interviewing me for a job, I am selling. I'm selling myself to you. And yes, you're selling your company and stuff to me, but I am, you know, realizing that that is an actual sales situation, I think, is step one. And that, and that it's okay.
It's not a bad word.
Right.
We talk about this concept in the book. It's called showing your work. Like in math class, like in high school, like you got credit for showing your work to the answer, not just showing the answer. So we have students all the time and they're like, I don't want to show up like some privileged USC kid that like just like is interviewing like everybody else. And like, what do I do? Like, how do I not show up that way? And we're like, you should show your work. Like, what do you mean? Like, do that, say that. Like, say the part that's in your head first before you say the right side of the equal sign. So these kids, these students will go in these interviews and they'll be like, you know what? I have not had the easiest time preparing for this interview. In fact, I even asked my 2 professors, like, how do I make sure I don't show up like the person I don't want to be? Because I don't want to be some privileged USC kid that like is entitled to this interview. And then what I realized was, and then they say the right side of the equal sign. And like, that's when people start to see themselves in you. Right? Like when you're not perfect, when you're perfectly imperfect, when you show what's going on inside of your head. And we saw it during the interview process. We were interviewing people that would talk to themselves out loud. Like, it's the craziest thing ever. But like, now that I say it, you probably do it all the time. Like, we're interviewing this guy. We're like, hey, like, tell us about yourself. My name is Jason. You know, I'm a senior vice president. And he stopped. Like, right when he was introducing himself, he stopped. And he looked up at the ceiling. He was like, what did I just do that for? I got to stop that. You're like, what? And then he looks at us, he's like, can I start again?
Oh.
And we're like, sure. Yeah, my name is Jason. I'm a father. I'm a philanthropist. He didn't want it to redefine himself. The point is that Garrett and I, after that interview, we were like, why did we like him so much? We've been deconstructing people, like trying to find the good, the bad, the indifferent. And for some reason, this guy, he took us on this high for those 3 seconds, that micro moment of connection. We were like, this is one of the greatest salespeople in the city. And for 3 seconds, we know he's not selling us. And like that high, we never came back down. Mm-hmm. And then we saw it like in every interview that we've ever done.
Yeah, I think 2 weeks later, we were interviewing one of the top trial lawyers in California. Yeah. And you talk about a selling job. He's representing a client, selling to the 12 members of the jury, while his competition is literally poking holes in his sale in real time. And he said he was making some kind of argument, and the judge interrupted him and said, hey, can you repeat what you just said? And we weren't talking to him, by the way, about talking to yourself out loud. He was just telling us a story. He goes, yeah, the judge interrupted me, and I stopped, and I looked up, and I went, what did I just say? He said, I looked back down, I go, Your Honor, I have no idea what I just said. And the jury laughed and the judge laughed. And for that moment, you know, he was just a nervous person in the courtroom, just like everybody else. And it wasn't a tactic. None of these people are doing this as a tactic. And that's another thing that differentiates great sellers, is that you could read sales books all day long and you could weaponize that stuff. And you say, oh, I know human psychology now, yeah, and I'm going to do this. And these people don't do that. He was vulnerable enough and comfortable enough to show his work. And for that moment, he wasn't that attorney who was going to say anything. He was just a person. And these people do that all the time.
I've done that. Mm-hmm. Never on purpose. But for example, I don't know, maybe a month ago, I was doing a live session and teaching people. There were tons of people on this live session. I was teaching them the difference between a Roth IRA and a 401k. And I've talked about this 1,000 times. Yeah. I know it like the back of my hand. But for some reason, like, combination of lack of sleep, stressful, like stuff going on in my personal life, I got it all jumbled and I started explaining the crisscross version. And I just got so nervous on this live that I said, like, give me a moment, please.
Yes.
And then I think I got it right the last time, but I was just so in my head about it. And at the end of it, the feedback, I like apologized profusely to everyone. I said, I'm so sorry. I don't know what's gotten into me. And the feedback was like, we love you, Erica. You're doing a great job. Yeah. And it was the nicest feedback.
That's the moment.
That makes perfect sense.
That's the moment. The moment when people see themselves in you is the moment. That's sales. Right? Like, you want someone to look for the good in you. You want someone to believe in you. Like, how do you get that? That's a hard chasm to cross. Like, what do? Like, you have to have that moment. That moment when someone goes, oh, this is Erica. Like, she's just like me. She's just like me. Like, I make mistakes. Like, people like value perfection in such this weird way. We forget that, like, we get an icky feeling when someone's too perfect. Like, it's a gut feeling. And if I let Garrett talk about science, he'll tell you like why it lives in the gut. But like, it's a gut feeling all the time. People do not like people that are perfect because we know it doesn't exist. Mm. So if people like to buy from people like themselves, how does a half black, half white Jewish guy relate to a 67-year-old Mormon, right? Like across the country. Like, the only thing that we have in common that I know of without ever meeting her is we're both imperfect. It's just a matter of like who's imperfect first. Mm. Like during COVID, like that was like lockdown was huge for us. We were seeing these groups of people that like were not good at selling. And then for some reason during lockdown, they were thriving. We had no idea why, but we saw these patterns that were emerging and they were all different verticals. So we knew it wasn't about like what they were selling. So they had to have been doing something in common. So we're like, why are these underachievers all of a sudden thriving during lockdown? We go and we start rewinding all the Zooms because we were in a position to be able to do that. And what we were finding was all of their conversations for the first 5 minutes sounded identical. They were like, hey, I don't even know if we should be having this conversation right now. Mm. Like, this is like very weird. That's my wife behind me, like trying to chase my 2-year-old to put on an adult size mask. Like, this is before we figured out how to like blur the backgrounds. Like, I don't even know if I should be in the same room as them. Like, really frantic. And I'm like, anyways, I'm sorry. I just want to call out the elephant in the room. And like all the time, you'd see these people on the other end of the Zoom go, oh, thank you for saying that. Like, this is so weird. This is my first pandemic too. Like, you would see these people live in this like shared experience. You've never seen a salesperson and a customer get on the same page in the first, you know, 36 seconds because they knew they were living in a shared experience. They knew that COVID experience they were living, that other person was living. And that's what we see in these unsold. Like, that's just a microcosm of what we're seeing in all these great sellers. Like, they know without a shadow of a doubt, they're living in a shared experience with the person they're talking to. And all they have to do is just show the piece of themselves that most people are hiding. Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, that's me. You're me. We see it all the time.
Yeah. That's what our message is all about. It's like, how do you get into that mindset where you genuinely and authentically care and want to ask those questions, mm-hmm. where you genuinely and authentically can give yourself permission to be that vulnerable, mm-hmm. Or to say those things.
We talk a lot about like when I was engaged, like I had this fiance who was a very big wedding planner. So she would take my work calendar and she would put our wedding, like planning invites in between my work meetings.
Oh.
Yes. She's industrious. She's, and, you know, like, I'm not going to tell my fiance I have a hard stop at 3 p.m. So what that means is that I would show up late to a lot of meetings. And I'd just show up and I'd be like, I'm so sorry. Like, I'm the leader of this organization. Like, I shouldn't be late. And I'd frantically, like, just justify it. I'm like, I have this fiance and, like, wedding planning and, like, bougainvilleas and tulips. It doesn't matter. I'm sorry. Like, I just want you to know I should have been here early. I will be early, you know, moving forward. And like the responses were always the same. Like, Colin, don't worry about it. It gets really easy on your second marriage. Quote, right? Colin, don't worry about it. Like, I've been married for 30 years. Happy wife, happy life. But it's like the minute that I said it was a moment that they saw themselves in me. The moment that they gave me grace. Like the moment that they realized that like it didn't matter how different we were. Like, oh, you are me. And maybe that wasn't the inflection point. Like maybe the inflection point was me realizing I saw myself in them. So I could treat them like someone, how are you adversarial with someone that's like you? So anyways.
But that's a paradigm shift for a lot of people.
Yeah.
That's like what we were talking about earlier about how you have this box that you think you're supposed to fit into as a seller or anything else. Like, you give yourself permission to be imperfect like that. And all of a sudden you can sell as a conversation or as yourself instead of as whatever the idea is that you have in your head.
When I started my online platform, it was just me for so long, doing every job needed to make things work. I remember spending hours and hours figuring out how to build a website, how to sell items online, and everything in between. I really believe the easier it is to get started, the quicker you can make money in your business. That's why I love Shopify. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. And you don't have to be a tech-savvy wizard. They've got you covered with their all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system for wherever and whatever you're selling. So it's no wonder Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US. What I love about Shopify is how, no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. Businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/Erica, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/Erica now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/Erica. I always think about how you remember from law school, when you're going through interviews for these law firms, there's so many interviews back to back. You're doing like 10 in a day. Mm-hmm. And there was this one interview that I got a call back, meaning the law firm really loved me. They said, we're going to fly you out to New York to do more interviews because we loved you so much. And I thought, what should I discuss on this interview? And I realized the whole time we talked about how she did ballet growing up, and I also did ballet growing up. And it was amazing. Like, there was nothing substantive, nothing related to the law that we talked about. Yet, because we were able to connect so quickly on the ballet topic, she walked away from the interview thinking, wow, Erica seems great, right? When really she didn't know anything about me.
That's perfect. And you weren't doing that as a tactic. You weren't like, oh, I'm going to get her to talk about ballet instead of my legal background. But like, that is what human connection is all about. And that's selling. Colin said earlier, that's how you move people. Mm-hmm. And that sounds like a perfect example.
What do you do if you're in conversation and you're just not connecting on anything? You're not finding that synergy, that topic that you align on?
Oh, that's my favorite
one. That is an amazing opportunity to show your work.
Show your work. You know what a gleek is?
No.
You know what a gleek is?
Gleek?
Yeah, a gleek.
No.
A gleek is like when you accidentally spit on someone, or you spit.
It like comes from under your tongue.
Like from the depths of your soul. Like,
is
you're just
that your
talking. No.
Absolutely.
Gleek on someone. Like, you'll be talking. I know multiple people in this room have gleeked on that. You're just talking, and then all of a sudden, and like, it just, the velocity is different, and it just like comes out of nowhere, okay? You've done it. Trust me.
I've definitely
even
done
if no
it,
one's
I
told
didn't,
you.
I didn't know like, it was worth.
Oh
that.
Shit! You just speaked up. No, it's good. So what I'm saying is like we tell this all the time. Garrett cringes every time I say it, but it's the
cringing
best.
Now.
It's the best analogy. There's two types of people in this world. The type of people that gleek on you and act like they didn't just hock a loogie on you. And the type of people that gleek on you and like, oh my God, I just spit on you. I'm so sorry. Like, we value the people that acknowledge their imperfections. Like, if you spit on me and you act like you didn't just spit on me, if you're talking and you jumble a word and you act like you didn't jumble a word, if you made a joke and it didn't land and you act like it landed, like that is the biggest turnoff you can have, as opposed to someone just being like, that was not funny.
So
I'm
to
gonna
take
work
it away
on
from spit and answer your question, yeah, if you feel like a conversation is not going great, it is perfectly okay to go, you know, like, I feel like this isn't landing. Or there are ways to say it, again, that are comfortable to you. And the way that you say that may be different than the way I say it or the way Colin says it. But it's probably okay, especially in a selling situation, to be like, you know, normally when I'm talking about this, I'm seeing my potential customers leaning in and they're excited. I'm not getting that. Like, is there something that's missing here? And just call it out and have the conversation in a way that feels right to you.
Yeah. Yeah, we say if you think you sound cheesy, you're right. Because
that's
true.
Another example of it, yeah.
Like Garrett and I could say the same exact thing. One of us could be cringing, like, oh my God, I just said that. And the other one of us could be like, damn, that felt good.
In an interview, what is the best way to answer the question, tell me about yourself?
For me, that's a hard question. So I would acknowledge that first. I would say that is a hard question. Because when I'm thinking about it, I go, well, I want you to know that I'm a philanthropist. Like, I want you to know that I'm a teacher. Like, I want you to know how much I care about my kids. But at the same time, like, this is a professional podcast. And I think what you actually care about is like who I am in the enterprise, like who I am as an author, who I am as like a friend of Garrett. So I'll answer the question and then I'll give you the answer. But that was that part was like me being honest, like showing my work on what was on the left side of the equal sign, like telling you how I was thinking about answering it. And then I'll give it to you on the right side by saying, I am a human being that really values like people. Like, you know, I have a lot of goals, but I view them as mile markers, not as finish lines. And I have this purpose, and if I'm being really honest, like I've manufactured this purpose so that I'm in the best part of the movie at every time, right? Which means even when I'm hitting my goals, like I'm still in the chase part of the movie. So if I'm telling you who I am, I'm the person that values being in the best part of the movie at every single moment I possibly can recognize that I am. But that was 20 seconds, right? And 40 seconds was me showing you how I was thinking about it. And like your viewers or listeners might think, yeah, I'm not hiring that dude.
Yeah, I was not going to hire you.
Damn it. So you wanted me to go first, you know?
But I mean, okay, I'm interested still. The showing me the work part, I think that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Like it just shows a little vulnerability. But then I feel like on the other half of the equation, you got to be sharp and on it. Like, maybe. Right?
I mean, I am not hiring you if you're too good. Because it's just too scripted. Mm-hmm. Like if I told you who I was, like without skipping a beat and like without making a hiccup and just being like boom, 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 boom. I'm like, okay, that didn't feel very impactful or genuine or authentic. So it just depends, right? To each his own. Like if you're not seeing yourself in me, that's okay. But at least I know I'm like showing up, like giving you my truth. You asked a really hard question. Like I'm not just going to BS you for 60 seconds. Like I'm going to at least give you 30 seconds of letting you know how I'm trying to answer it. And then 30 seconds of, okay, I think I figured it out. Here's the answer. As opposed to 60 seconds of an act. And maybe it works and maybe it doesn't. But we have a really good track record for our students. Because this is the hardest thing for them to do. Like how do I brag about myself? How do you brag about yourself? Like it's the hardest thing in the world to brag about yourself.
So how do you teach them that?
The concept of showing your work. Like, what are you grappling with? Like, what are your issues that you can't answer this question confidently? Like, what's the process that you're going through to figure out how to show up like as the best version of yourself? Are you supposed to show up as the best version of yourself? Like, these are really interesting conversations that people care about.
I think maybe I still don't buy it. That's why I'm having a little skepticism.
You might value like, perfection. You might want me to be perfect.
Maybe. Yeah, that's that.
Yeah.
Part of why Colin and I work so well together, aside from just being best friends, is that we're very different. And he's giving you a very emotional answer. My answer will probably be more logical, and which makes sense. Because
and that appeals to me. I know that.
That's exactly it. So every sale, whether you're selling yourself in an interview or selling your product or anything else, is some combination of logic and emotion. Sometimes it's 90-10, sometimes it's 50-50. Part of it is self-awareness. Who am I talking to? If I'm talking to a very logical person, I probably want to speak more logically about facts and specs and figures versus, you know, this is how you're going to feel when you're driving this car or using this product. So I agree with everything Colin's saying about showing your work, and I do think that's important. A more logical answer is that once you've acknowledged that, however top-heavy you want to lean in on that, and for you that might be less, then you want to answer the question with something that can't be found on the resume, because they know your backstory. They know where you went to school and they know what your job history was. How do you then weave the things that you're excited about telling them and wanting to tell them into an interview answer? And that's where that preparation comes in again, too. And one of the pieces of advice that we give to all of our students, and we do this big interview class every semester. One of the pieces of advice we give is, you know, have three or four stories. Real stories about your life that you can adapt to any question. Because you know you're going to get the question about, like, what's your weakness? They might not ask it that way. They might not say, what's your biggest weakness? But they're going to say, you know, tell me about a time you struggled or whatever. Have that story and tell me about this or tell me about that. If you have three or four stories about things that you're proud of, challenges that you've overcome, and you can in real time then adapt and have the conversation, weaving one of those stories in and making the point that you need to make, that's a very logical way to do that. So I think if you can find whatever combination you're comfortable with of how do I let them in on here's what I want to tell you versus what I'm worried you want to hear, but also here's some stories and some things that you're not going to find on the resume that's in front of you, you're probably going to have a winning answer there.
Got it. Okay. So Colin's answer would have very much appealed to someone who is emotional. And then your answer-ish would have appealed to someone who's logical. So that means that as soon as possible during this interview, you need to figure out whether the interviewer is logical or emotional, right?
It's less about the interviewer and more about you also. I mean, yes, you want to communicate in their language and you're going to figure that out. But I think if it's the first question in an interview, which it probably is, and you're telling us that you're more logical and you don't quite want to let people in yet and show them the work, you want to answer the question in a way that you're comfortable. Because otherwise you're going to be back to that faking it, which is the seller that we all don't want to be.
Mm. Yeah, I challenge it a little. Like, he just did a great job of showing his work for 2 minutes. Like, that was
in a logical way.
Sure. But like, we did the same thing, right? Like, he was telling you exactly what he was thinking and it landed with
that
you.
That landed.
But literally the same thing though. Like, he didn't actually answer a question. The last 2 minutes was him telling you how he was thinking about answering it.
That's true.
Right? So it doesn't matter if you're, like, Gare and I interview a lot of people. Like, we help people interview a lot of people. And like, our rule of thumb is, like, can we hire people for you, for us, that have the hardest stuff to train? Like, it is so hard to train someone to be vulnerable. It is so hard to train someone to be authentic, to be coachable, to be optimistic, to be curious, to be creative. Like, that takes a long time to teach someone. I can teach you X's and O's. I can teach you the tactical stuff immediately, but I'd like to hire people that have the hardest stuff already down. Mm-hmm. So when I'm interviewing someone or helping someone interview someone and they're showing their work and they're showing pieces of themselves that the last 10 people have been way too good to hide, like, I'm hiring that person. Like, hands down, doesn't matter, because at least I know what I'm getting. Like, I can see inside and then I can map it to what came out, as opposed to someone that had just the right answer, logical or emotional. So, I mean, we're different people for sure, but we both did the same thing and it landed with you.
Yeah.
One of them did.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. So every interview that I conduct, before it even gets to the interview stage with me, they have to submit a Loom video. So they have up to 5 minutes that they can say anything that they want to on a video. And it is very interesting how different people use those 5 minutes. The prompts we give them are, tell us who you are, what you do, and why you could bring value to us. And some people use it to tell me for 4 minutes about their dog and how much they love their hobbies, and then like 1 minute business. Some people use it for 5 minutes, what we can do for you. And it's just super interesting to get into the weeds of how people think about how they best allocate those 5 minutes. And I think the best ones that I've seen are not the ones that use all 5 minutes to just hit me with all the facts of why I should hire them. it's a some touch of personal vulnerability showing the work.
Yeah.
And each one's going to be different because they're comfortable with different ratios.
So. Yeah.
The brain's also so malleable. Like, if you look for something, you will find it. Like, as an interviewer, as an interviewee, like, if you're looking for the good in someone, you'll find it. If you're looking for the bad in someone, you'll find it. So, like, that there's an element of that. Like, if you know that you have no idea yet, I don't know if you're looking for the good in me or not. So, like, what am I supposed to do?
Yeah.
And that's where that process starts. Like, let's see if I can just be a real version of myself, the real version of my authentic professional self, where you see yourself in me. Mm. And the goal is not for you to see yourself in me. The goal is for me to be such a real one in a professional setting where you're like, oh, yes.
Change.
I know exactly what that feels like. And then you start, like, that's what sales is, right? Like, you're looking for people to believe in you. You're looking for people to want to look for the good in you. And that is a very, very hard thing to do when you're walking into an interview setting when you have to sell me. Like, how do I level the playing field so it's not like you're up here and I'm here? Like, you have to see me.
Yeah.
And the only way to really see me is if you see me in you. And that's the whole show your work cycle we're talking about.
Yeah.
You guys know that I love investing because you know that if your money is just sitting in a bank account, you're losing out to inflation every single year. That's why you invest it so that it grows for you without you having to put in any extra work. I've been using an investing app called Webull for almost 4 years, and I had them do something really special for my listeners. By using my link to sign up today, you can get between 6 to 12 fractional shares for free. All you need to do is open an account and deposit any amount, even a dollar, to claim your free shares. So just by depositing a dollar, you'll get between 6 to 12 free fractional shares. And if you're wondering what to actually invest in, we talk all about investing in episode 28, so go ahead and listen to that episode. To claim your free shares through my special link, just go to ericataughtme.com/invest or click the link in the show notes. And it's Erica with a K. Again, that's ericataughtme.com/invest. If you're listening, let me guess. You have a passcode on your phone. And let me take another wild guess and say that you have a password on your computer. But why are so many of us okay just being completely unprotected online? We have no idea who has all our personal information online and whether it's the good guys or the bad guys who might be selling your information or worse. We're talking spammers, telemarketers, robocallers, people who want to know more about you and even where you live. My sister had her data leaked online, and because of that, her identity was stolen, and it was a nightmare to deal with. We had to lock down all her credit cards just for starters. That's why I'm excited to tell you about Aura, a sponsor of this episode. Aura can identify data brokers exposing your info and submit opt-out requests on your behalf. When I discovered it, I knew I had to try it out just to see if my information had been leaked online, which they let me see instantly after I signed up. And get this, for my audience, they're offering a free 14-day trial so you can see if your personal information has been leaked online. To find out now, go to ericataughtme.com/aura to claim your free 14-day trial. Erica with a K, and Aura is spelled A-U-R-A. Again, that's ericataughtme.com/aura, and I'll also leave the link in the show notes.
I know you work a lot with companies. When you go into a company and you're trying to help them improve their sales team, what kind of framework do you create for them to improve their sales team?
That was one of the most fun parts about the book writing process, was figuring out how do we come up with these ways where people can actually put this stuff into practice. And so the best example I can give you is there's a traditional sales training exercise called the 3x3 that a lot of typical sales trainers will teach. And basically the premise of it is that before any sales call, sales conversation, sales meeting, you spend 3 minutes doing research about the person or people that you're going to talk to. And the subtext there is, okay, we're going to do some research and find things that we can leverage in the conversation. So like we used to sell software security. It might be, if we were being taught by these traditional trainers, they might be, oh, if you did some research and found out that their company had a security breach, you could use that in the conversation. Or you could just do some research about them and use it to build rapport. And that's fine. Research in a sales conversation is important. But we never liked that because it always had this weird subtext of like you're leveraging it against the person that you're talking to. And so we have changed it and adapted it over the years. And we teach salespeople, young and old, to spend that 3 minutes doing research. But instead of looking for three things that you can leverage in the conversation, look for three things that you could love, literally love, about the person that you're going to talk to. We do that exercise the first session of our class every semester.
Yeah.
So we've got these 60 students who think they've signed up for a sales mindset class, and we tell them, okay, we give them 10 minutes. We're gonna pair you up with somebody in class who you don't already know, and you're gonna spend 10 minutes falling in love with each other. And we give them one piece of advice. We say, the only hint we're gonna give you is focus on the questions that you would need to ask them in order to have the chance of falling in love with this person. We see a lot of eye rolls, and they're like, I thought this was a sales class, and what am I doing
here? It's just cheesy.
But they go and they do the exercise because they're a captive audience at that point. And without fail, every single semester, every single pair falls in love. And it's magic. We'll have like a future Olympic swimmer sitting with like the next Mark Zuckerberg. They have nothing in common. And they're like, the F word comes up. It's fate. It's fate that we sat next to each other. I changed majors as a sophomore and they changed majors as a sophomore. Or like this past semester, we had two students. One of them was from a remote village in China that nobody outside of that area has heard of. And the person she was falling in love with, his mother was from the exact same village. Like it's fate that we sat next to each other. But you know, we dig in, we have a conversation afterwards and we talk about what actually happened. And without fail, every single time, the moment that people fall in love with the person they're talking to is the moment they see themselves in that person.
Mm.
Every single time.
And we never asked them to do that.
We didn't ask them to do that.
We asked them to fall in love. We didn't ask them to ask questions that were rooted in their own values. We didn't ask them ask questions like based on what they cared about. We were like, you got one shot, focus on questions, you have to fall in love, what do you do?
Mm.
And that's what they did. Because once again, it's hard to have an adversarial relationship with yourself. And so they immediately were trying to find themselves in other people. Your framework question, just to give you like a different answer, because that's an interesting one, but a tie-in to this is, like, we talk a lot with our students about a purpose framework. And the reason why we do it is because students and professionals are so goal-oriented. It's just like,
yeah.
I want to write my goals down, I want to achieve them. And we started like writing this book and we're doing all this research, and what we were finding were these like exceptional people out there wouldn't answer our questions around goals. They just wouldn't. Every time we ask them about their goal orientation, they shoehorned the word purpose in. We're like, we're not asking you about your purpose. This is not that book. Like, tell us about your goals. And it was unimportant to them, to the point where like at some point they were like, sure, you want to talk? Let's talk about goals for a second. Salespeople don't wake up one day and decide to be smarmy, manipulative, yucky. Like managers, leaders, they don't show up one day and decide to be hypocrites or mean or curmudgeons. Like that's not what happens. Like that is when your back's against the wall, you're not hitting your goals and you start to act unnaturally. And we were like, huh, yeah, we've been there before. And they're like, what happens when you hit your goal? Like everyone we're talking to are saying some version of, have you ever hit a goal? And then you thought to yourself, I thought this was gonna feel different. Like, have you ever hit a goal and you were like, damn, this is it?
You gotta set another one.
That's, right?
That's your reward, is you celebrate for a few minutes, maybe a few days if you're lucky, and then it's on to the next one.
And this framework that like that we put into place was because we found that these really successful people were viewing goals not like finish lines. They were viewing them as mile markers, which meant that like once they hit it, they weren't like, this is it. They were like, oh, that's just one step closer to this purpose I have. But our students were never trained to have a purpose writing framework or a purpose statement. Like we were all about goals. So like when we get in front of our students and we show them how to write a purpose statement, how to manufacture being in the best part of the movie at any given moment, and how your goals are leading up to purpose, and how you can write like purpose driven goals so that you can attach your purpose to your goals. Like that framework has changed a lot of our students' lives, because like they're asking questions rooted in what their purpose is. And then you see them in interviews and they're like, the interview went so well, what happened? I'm like, I don't know, like at some point I just realized that this was a purpose-driven person, because real recognizes real. Like, if you've done a purpose-driven exercise, you're talking to someone, you're like, oh, I know exactly who I'm talking to. Or like you, you're actually a great example. How could I not like you if you're helping me serve my purpose? So I see my purpose in you. So, but if I don't have a purpose and I don't see my purpose in you, so I don't move differently and I don't treat you differently than everybody else. So I think the purpose framework is another one that has really shifted mm-hmm. how people think about selling themselves, let alone their ideas.
So can you take me through how to go through this purpose framework exercise? Like, what if I have a notebook, what do I do?
Yeah.
Yeah. You mean like...
We got a great book that has a very simple, but no, exactly. In truth, there's no right way to do it. And that's sort of our overarching message with selling and leading and everything else. It's like, there's no one way to do it. The way that works for you to sell and lead people is going to be different than the way that works for me. So you can go online and you can Google purpose statement or how do I make a purpose statement, and you'll find some great ways to do it. We have a version in there, and the version that we teach in our class is very much quick and dirty. Like, what are traits that make you you? Mm. So like, if we asked your friends, what are a couple of traits that make you you, what would they say? Taking those and then focusing on times when you felt most complete and fulfilled and yourself, and thinking back, one of our favorite exercises to do with people is to go, okay, think of like four different times in your life, starting at childhood on to recent, where you have just genuinely felt like, I'm in my zone. I am happy, I am at my best, I'm in flow, whatever that means to you. And then look at all those moments and see what they have in common. Are you with other people? Are you alone? Are you creating? Are you just consuming? It's different for everybody, but there are probably things that those have in common. So taking the traits that make you you, and then those moments, and creating a statement around that kind of creates this ideal. That quick and dirty version has worked really well for a lot of people. And then, you know, this is another exercise that we do with our students. And when they do that, we love to see how they go off on their own. We give them a week or two on their own after they do the version that we teach.
Yeah.
And they just come up with such amazing things, like such inspiring things. And it makes us so happy and hopeful at this generation that we're lucky enough to get to hang out with, because, man, they're mission driven and they know what they want to do and they want to do big things. And it's fun to see people take it for their own.
I'm curious what the answer is, because earlier you were alluding to one of my interview tactics being in the book. So I was telling you that for my interviews, when I first started, I am naturally very analytical, a researcher. So I researched everything I could about a person. The way it turned out was I would know more about them than they knew about themselves. Like, I could recite something they said in a 2014 interview and they would have no idea what I was talking about. And also, when they would answer questions, a lot of these people answer the same ways, the same questions over and over again. So I would be bored by their answer because I would know exactly the way the story went. Mm-hmm. And so then I switched completely, where now I know very little about my guests. I come on just curious to learn. I have obviously the basics, but I definitely don't read the book. I definitely don't do thorough research. And you told me that was actually a tactic that you use in your book.
Tactic is the right word. Yeah. I don't know if tactic is the right word.
Okay, tell me.
It's part chapter of our two, modality. If you read the book, chapter two is called intentional ignorance.
Okay.
And what you are doing is staying intentionally ignorant, because you know that by intentionally ignoring what you could know about us, if you had read the book or listened to other interviews we'd done or read anything else about us, you will show up differently. And all of these amazing sellers that we talk to, and we have tons of amazing examples of this, they stay intentionally ignorant to the things that are going to prevent them from showing up as their best self.
Ray Lewis has this great quote, and he says, they pay me for what I do. Ray Lewis is no football player. Just in case. You looked at me like, I know who Ray Lewis is.
Assume somebody doesn't.
But just assume someone
doesn't. He's a great NFL football
Hall of Famer. And he said, like, they pay me for what I do Monday to Saturday, but Sundays are free. And we're interviewing all these people and we're realizing that they all know their Sunday moments. Like, they all know what they love so much about their job that they would do it for free. They would be solving that problem on Sunday morning. And also, like, what they pay me for, right? And we were finding that everyone that we were interviewing, because they knew what their Sunday moment was, they were able to clearly articulate the parts of their job that they have to show up inauthentically passionate about. And it's almost like they know what their dharma is. And so at that point, when you know what you love doing, you have a choice to make, which is, do I have a team around me who loves different things, that owns different dharma, so that you can be intentionally ignorant, so you don't have to show up. Mm. We interviewed like a top salesperson, he was like number one salesperson at like some unicorns. And now he's like a number one salesperson at this huge startup. It's not a startup, it's $8.5 billion company now, but they still call themselves a startup. And we're like, why does everyone keep saying that you sell the unsellable? Because that's what everyone can talk to this guy. We're like, why do they say that? He's like, I don't know. Like, I don't have a process. I'm like, well, what do you do? And he was like, someone hands me a lead, right? I don't look at where the lead comes from. I don't look at any of the data. Like, I talk to myself for a little bit, give myself a pep talk, and then I show up. And Garrett and I are like blown away. We're like, you don't look at the data? Like, the data the company pays for that's supposed to help you sell better? Like, why aren't you looking at the data? And he goes, because I know that people buy more in the Southwest than the Northeast. And if I know that someone's from the Northeast, I'm going to treat them differently immediately. Mm-hmm. So I am intentionally ignorant. And we're like, of course you sell the unsellable. Like, we interviewed an ad tech executive who told us that the moment her career changed forever was when she decided that she was going to acknowledge she didn't like technology. We're like, what? She was like, yeah. I used to always act like I had the answers, but I didn't. I just had the words until someone like started pulling the covers off. And then it was like, I am now being shown I am inauthentically trying to explain my way out of a hole that I dug for myself. I started saying, I don't know, but I will go and find out for you. I will fight for you. And she was like, I saw like a stark difference how people treated me. Like, they were giving me more credit for being resourceful and going out and finding answers for them than just always having them at the ready.
And that's why mindset is our whole thing. Like, that's why our class is Sales Mindset for Entrepreneurs. You can go and you can learn how to build rapport and overcome objections and ask for the close anywhere. But the people who are doing it the best are thinking about it differently. It's like, how do I get into that frame of mind where I am going to care differently, where I am going to ask those better questions and be the best version of myself? And so if you can create that infrastructure around you to be like, there are certain things you just have to know in your job. Mm-hmm. You can't intentionally ignore certain things. But above and beyond those, are there things where you could go, you know, I don't necessarily need to know that. I have a client who could come in and talk about that, or a coworker, or there's a resource that I can give them instead so that I don't have to sit there and pretend to be somebody I'm not. It's like, how do you give yourself permission to be the most authentic version of yourself as much as possible?
When you are going into a company, how do you help them identify which salespeople are going to become stars versus which are not?
That's a hard one to answer. Yeah. Because we have done that with companies. We do that with companies that we work for and with. But it's very different and it's very subjective. It kind of depends what you're selling. It kind of depends on the industry you're in. Is it an enterprise sale that takes 12 to 18, sometimes more months? Or is it something that you're going to close on the first call? You're looking for different things. So I don't want to give an answer that somebody's going to be listening and go, that just doesn't apply to me. But I will say that if you go back to when we were talking about the interviews and we were talking about hiring for the intangibles, that's the stuff that you want to vet out as quickly as possible in that first 30 days. Mm. Does that person have the things required in your particular business or industry that are really hard to teach? That take, like, yes, you can teach people things that will increase their emotional intelligence. It's a fact, and your emotional intelligence increases over time, but it's hard and it takes a long time to make somebody who's not super self-aware into a more self-aware person. So those types of things, if you can vet those out in the early days versus they're nervous giving a demo or they don't know the facts about the product or they don't, you know, they botch, that stuff you can teach. So I think it goes back to what we were talking about earlier about the intangibles. I do focus most on that in the early days and then go from there.
Yeah. The most dangerous person in the room is a person that lacks self-awareness.
Yeah.
Like, it is very, very scary. And yeah, that comes to question asking. Like, if I had to answer your question more direct, I would say, is this person self-aware enough to know what's happening? Like, that's what I would be looking for. Like, for instance, is this person self-aware enough to know what their goal is? Like what the intention is of the conversation that they're having. Like, Barbara Walters did this great interview and they were like, how do you get people to cry all the time when they know that you're the interviewer that like makes people cry and you get them all emotional? Like, how do you continue to get people to cry when they're saying out loud, she will not make me cry. And she's like, I don't know. Like, I don't really have a process. I mean, it's very simple. Like, if I had to boil it down, like, I write a bunch of questions on a bunch of note cards. I throw out the ones that I don't, you know, really love. I reorder the questions. And then I start again. I write, I throw away, I reorder, right? Throw away, reorder. And the operative word is reorder. Like, she is self-aware enough to know what the order is that she wants to know information. Mm-hmm. Like, that doesn't make her like the greatest interviewer in the world. That just makes her very special because she's self-aware enough to know what she wants and what's happening. So she'll ask Will Smith a question or anybody a question, right? Like, how did it impact you when your parents got divorced? And everyone assumes, oh, that's the finish line, right? So that's not gonna make me cry. Like, it was fine. But that was never her finish line, right? Like, she's self-aware enough from the beginning to understand that what she actually wanted to know was how it impacted them. She just started with that question. So the second question is the one that gets people crying. She's like, okay, and how did that divorce affect your mother specifically? And they're like, oh. And the waterworks come. She's not like intentionally trying to make people cry. She's just the most self-aware person in the room, so much so that she knows what questions she wants to ask, when she wants to ask them, in the order of information she wants to hear, because she understands it'll build. Mm-hmm. Like, that's social awareness, that's self-awareness.
So that's what you're looking for in the first 30 days is?
Self-awareness. Do you know what, yeah, do you know, are you self-aware enough to understand like what you're doing, why you're doing it? Like, it's less about, I think, even in the first 30 days, about being socially aware. Mm-hmm. It's just like, do you know yourself? You talk to somebody in a room who is not self-aware, someone that doesn't realize how they sound, that's someone you do not want representing your brand. Yeah. That's when your brand integrity starts to get real diluted, when someone's out there talking about you and doesn't realize what they sound like, doesn't realize they just gleeked on somebody, you know? Sorry to bring it back to the gleek. But
stop.
I just figured, I know it makes you uncomfortable, so I figured I'll just do it myself.
I just interviewed someone today, and it was a unique interview. I've never done anything like this, where it was a Zoom call. And it was a 2-hour interview, by the way, which I also usually don't do, but wow. I think I'm going to hire this guy. And maybe like an hour into it, I decided to show the job description on the Zoom call, shared my screen. And I said, let's go through every part of this job description and you rate yourself 1 through 10 of how good you are at this. And it was very eye-opening because he was so self-aware. Some things he told me 8, 9, he didn't say 10 for anything, which I also like. And then some, he gave me an honest 3 or 4, but each time he gave me a 4, he said, look, this isn't my strong suit, but here's how I'm working on improving it. Or here's how I think you could hire someone else on the team to really complement my skills that I do have. And it was fascinating just how self-aware this person was. And that made me feel like I got to hire this guy.
That is an excellent example because you got sold. Mm-hmm. And I don't say that with any negative judgment. Like, you got sold in the best way possible. And it's another misconception that people have when they're selling. They think that they have to keep the customer. And in this case, you were the customer, the person he was trying to sell on himself. They have to keep the customer at a high all the time. And we can't have anything bad go. We can't say anything bad about our product. We can't acknowledge competitors. We can't do these things. But it's just wrong. People know that there are competitors and they know that no product is perfect and they're not looking. That's where that smell test comes in and you're like, oh, this is a little too perfect. Like, it is okay to show the parts that aren't perfect. The best thing you can do if you're interviewing, if you're selling, is acknowledge the imperfection and then acknowledge what you're doing about it. That's a piece of advice that we give to our students all the time too. Like, when you get that, what's your biggest weakness type question? You're gonna tell them the story about when that weakness manifested, but you're also gonna tell them that you're self-aware enough to know that that weakness exists and what you're doing about it to make it better.
Yeah.
That's real selling.
Asking somebody their weakness it's a great experience, either on the interviewing side or on the interviewer side.
Yeah.
Just like, how do you tell someone like what you're bad at when you want the person to want you? And that paradigm shift of, oh, like, they could want me because I'm not perfect. That's a very hard pill to swallow early on in your career.
But it's true.
Like, it doesn't, for me personally, but I think I can represent both of us, like, the arc of your career is really interesting because it, at some point, you know, you realize it. Like, you realize, like, I'm supposed to be perfect. I'm supposed to have all the answers. Like, I'm supposed to stay away from the friction. Like, I'm supposed to stay away from problems. And then you get to this point in your career where you're like, anybody that's doing anything of significance is solving really big problems. How am I supposed to solve really big problems if I keep avoiding problems, if I keep avoiding friction? And then you see that part in your career where, like, you start looking for the problems, you start looking for the friction, you start living in those areas. And that is full circle to this conversation.
I think I had an epiphany because of you guys. So I always thought I was hiring for talented, competent people, but I think I'm hiring for self-aware people. Because I'll tell you, the last two hires I made, I did something. In the interview, I always say, hey, if I called your boss today and said, you know, so-and-so, I know she's great, but what is her biggest weakness? What would they say? And I have them answer. And then when I go to the reference check and I call their boss, I ask the same question. I ask the boss, hey, I interviewed so-and-so, what would you say is their greatest weakness? And if those align, I hire the person, because I think that is telling you a lot about how self-aware you are. And sometimes you hear people say completely different things from what their boss says. Their boss just told me that they forget tasks, they get overwhelmed a lot. And they said their attention to detail is their biggest weakness. And there's that misalignment. But right. I think that epiphany that you guys just gave me is I need to hire for self-awareness. That's what I need to be looking for.
It's the hardest thing to train.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things like coachability, self-awareness, optimism. And by the way, I don't confuse optimism with realism as being, you know, counterparts. Like that's not like, these are things that are just really hard to train. Like really hard. But if you can hire someone that has all that, you can teach them anything else and you're golden. I don't know how long it takes someone to train to teach someone to be self-aware, but I don't think we've ever done it in one semester.
No.
No. So you don't have time to do that, you know? So yeah, self-awareness is, we said it earlier, you know, when you asked us like, what are the characteristics of like great salespeople? Like, they're not the most self-confident people in the room. They're the most self-aware people in the room. They know they said something, it didn't land. They're able to course correct real time. They are socially aware too. They do talk to people. They do realize that the person is not listening to them. They're waiting to speak and they can shift. But like these are characteristic traits that have nothing to do with like what most people think you need to be good at your job or like why we're hiring you. Think about entry-level jobs. This is the most fascinating thing to me. There's a lot of entry-level jobs now that require 3 to 5 years experience. How in the world are you going to go to college and then graduate and you can't get a job without 3 to 5 years experience when you were just in college? So like, what is that's the gap. The delta that they can't hire you for is because you don't have those skills, because you haven't been in the work setting enough to realize these emotionally intelligent characteristic traits that are the most important. How do you navigate ambiguity? How do you make decisions? And how do you lead and influence people authentically? How do you want to give feedback? Right? Like yeah. Versus like, I can teach someone to give feedback, but how do like you want, can you teach someone to like want to give feedback? Like I want to have your back. Like these are really hard things that take a lot of time to master. These are the skills that we're hopefully harnessing in this book.
So a big thing we've been talking about is this authenticity and how selling really just means authentically showing up as yourself. How do you kind of resist the urge to hold back? Like sometimes I know people can feel like, maybe people don't want to see my full authentic self, or maybe they won't think it's professional or the way they expect me to be. How do you resist that urge or fight that urge to hold it back?
Yeah, it's a really common concern that we get a lot. We interviewed Chef Roy Choi, who sort of reimagined the food truck landscape in his, you know, TV shows, et cetera. He's a big dog right now in the room and he's doing great things. And he had this line in the book, but during the interview, it just floored me. And he was like, I have multiple authentic versions of myself. And it just out of nowhere, he like needed us to know, like the authentic version of you as a father, as a son, as an entrepreneur, as a student, like these are all authentic versions of yourself, but they're not all just one authentic version. And you can have multiple authentic versions of yourself. And that was interesting. And then the next day we interviewed Ari Melber from MSNBC. And he said, you know, authenticity has boundaries. Like I would prefer to show up with like a t-shirt and like tattooed sleeves, but like I need the people to like hear me and look for that in me, like look for the good in me, look for reasons to believe. And therefore like I have to create my authenticity within the confines of what is acceptable. So like, it's interesting because there's a way to show up as the most authentic version of yourself in a setting where you're not overboard. Like you're not offending people because you're self-aware enough to know what is offensive and what isn't. So I would, you know, I guess the long answer is I would compartmentalize. Mm. Like what authentic version of myself are we talking about? And then be self-aware enough to understand like what this is going to mean for this interaction and then go from there. And then worst case scenario, show your work. Like if you go out of bounds, say it. Be like, that did not land well. Like in my head, that was gonna sound a lot better, but the reality is, and that might not work for you, logically speaking, right? As opposed to emotionally.
But like most skills or traits, it's also something that gets better with practice. It's a muscle that you need to flex.
Sure.
And so if you're one of these people out there going, oh, this sounds great. I wanna be the most authentic version of myself, but I'm just not quite feeling like I'm there yet. Start with a little bit. Start with showing your work a little bit and see how that feels and then progress from there. It's not necessarily, for some people, being that authentic comes with a lot of discomfort. And so treating it as a muscle and going a little bit further each time and seeing what works for you is probably the way I would recommend doing it for those types of people.
I wanted to ask, besides reading The Unsold Mindset, if someone comes to you and says they want to become better at sales, what are three action points you're going to give them?
That's an impactful question that we've never been asked before. I like that you said three.
That's why it's impactful.
That's why it's impactful.
Number one, the conversations that you have with yourself are typically way more important than the conversations you have with other people. That's the first one.
Yeah, I think acknowledging the times you are selling that you don't realize you're selling. So when you're trying to talk your roommates into going to Chinese food for dinner instead of Italian food for dinner, like that's a sale. And realizing that you have those moments or those micro moments every single day, and thinking about how you act when you're successfully doing that versus how you act when you consciously are like, ooh, I'm selling now and I do this. Just that labeling, that like, what do they say? Name it to tame it or whatever, some cheesy thing like that. Like once you label that and see that you're selling, you can immediately start to get better at it by just realizing that you don't have to do things that you maybe think you're supposed to.
Okay. And then the third is, I think the malleability of the brain. Like people just don't get it enough or early enough. You will find whatever you are looking for. People will find whatever they are looking for. If you look for the good, you'll find it. If you look for the bad, you'll find it. So, you know, in the context of self-awareness, like what are you looking for? And make sure that you know that when you are walking into a selling situation. And if all of us, so often, like we're in a selling situation, we're looking for reasons they're not going to say yes, reasons they're not going to invest. We're trying to get ready to overcome the objection. But if you were looking for the good in them, like what would that look like? How would you show up? What questions would you ask? What would you laugh at, you know, versus waiting to speak?
So another important sales conversation that most people should have in their careers is about salary negotiation, how to get a raise. Mm-hmm. So what are your sales tactics? I know you don't like the word tactics, but what are your sales tactics for that?
Yeah, we've talked about this before, but it's the best approach. If you're uncomfortable talking about getting a raise and you're looking for the good in the person that you're talking to, meaning they'll understand, they've asked for a raise before, right? Like they see like the value in me. That makes it, that's the conversation you're having with yourself first. That makes that conversation a lot easier where you could just share that part with them and you can say it. You can say, I came here to ask for a raise. It has not been easy. Like over the last week, here's what I've been doing to prepare for this. I was looking at, you know, what, like how much revenue like I've made for the company and where the role gaps are in our organization and how I can add more value and how 1 + 1 = 3. And at the end of the day, like what I realized was like, that's not enough to get promoted. Like the reason why I should get promoted is because I care more about this company than anybody else or whatever, right? Like whatever your honest truth is. But you gave them all the bragging points, not because you were trying to brag, but because you were just you were showing the work, right? You were telling them, I'm not sure how to answer this because I have a lot of answers, but if you were going to make me give you one, it's not what you think. It's because like no one is going to stay up calling Australia on Thursday night when everybody else is at the bar drinking Jameson with their friends. Like nobody else is going to be thinking about solving these problems on Sunday more than me. But you gave him all the logical stuff first. Garrett said something earlier. He said, you know, there's no sale that doesn't include logic and emotion. You know, your emotion is justifying your logic. Your logic is justifying your emotion. We work really well together because we sort of personify that. And so people can see themselves in logic. They can see themselves in emotional, or normally see themselves somewhere in the middle. But that, I think that's my long, long-winded answer.
And if you're talking about somebody who's negotiating a salary for a job they don't have yet, a line that we love, that we have had used or told to us, and that we have suggested other people say is, I wouldn't be the person that you want in this role if I didn't ask for more money. Or if I didn't ask if it's possible to do X, Y, Z with my salary. Like, there are ways to show your work and soften it and say, you know, like, you're hiring me, say, for a sales role. I wouldn't be the salesperson you want me to be if I didn't ask if there's some wiggle room in this salary. The only thing I'll add to that is I heard a story earlier this week about somebody who they were having a conversation about salary for a new job, agreed on the salary, got the offer. And then they came back a couple of days later and asked for more money. And the potential employer said they were just so turned off by that because it wasn't the appropriate time. And it goes back to the self-awareness that we've been talking about a little bit. But if you're not self-aware enough to know the appropriate time to ask for those and have those conversations, you could get yourself into some trouble. Like, there is a time where it's perfectly okay to say, yeah, I could use some more money. But if you've already had that conversation, then gotten the offer, you know, maybe not in every case, but in this particular case, it turned the employer off enough to literally go, sorry, we're not doing that. And they gave the job to somebody else. So
yeah.
There are pitfalls, and you have to have that self-awareness to look out for them.
We actually had that same situation too, because it went from being something admirable where it is, I am happy that they're advocating for themselves, to if it's done after the contract has already been agreed upon, it just feels like taking advantage of the employer. And we had that situation, and it wasn't a good feeling for us. We ultimately, I think, gave that person the offer, but they didn't last more than 60 days because there just wasn't a cultural fit. And that, like, taking advantage of theme continued on.
How do you not know, like, this back to self-awareness, like, how do you not know what that sounds like? Right? Like that feeling that you had, like, after the fact, like that's actually what goes on in your head. You're like, how does this person not know what this looks like? I do not want to hire somebody that's not aware of what this looks like, because this is obvious. So if they don't know what this looks like, what else do they not know? What else is going to come out of their mouth when they're representing my brand that they're not aware of how they actually look?
Yeah.
Self-awareness.
Yeah.
Also, I just want to say that impactful questions is always a great way to negotiate.
So we have a closing tradition. The podcast is called Erica Taught Me, but really today is all about Colin and Garrett Taught Me. So what do you want people to walk away saying, Colin and Garrett taught me this?
If there's one thing that you take away from this, it's that there's no one right way to be a great seller. Everybody is selling themselves or an idea or somebody else's idea. You could be really logical about it. You could be really emotional about it. Garrett and I normally have completely different answers, but we always end up in the same place. So, like, this is a great example of that. Like, he was going to say, there's not one right way to do this. And I was going to say, there's not one right way to do it. But if we were each going to tell you what the right way was, it would come here and we would meet in the middle.
Beautifully said. I was going to say that. But since I don't like when he has the last word, I'm going to say something different just for fun. I also, in addition to that, which is the correct answer, hope that people walk away realizing that it is possible to maximize the time in your day of the things that you would do for free. There are parts of your job, there are parts of your life that you would do for free. And if you can find a way to turn those things into the actual thing that you do every day, it's really magical. I get to travel around with my best friend, talk to amazing people, stand on stages and talk to more like people we've never met before about a subject we're passionate about. And while it's certainly not every minute of our day, the more that we can maximize that, the better. And so even though that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with selling, I just think that's a nice message to leave with that. That's a really cool goal to have, and I recommend it for everybody.
Thank you both so much. This was awesome.
This was great.
It was really fun.
If you've enjoyed the episode, please take a moment to leave a review. It really helps support what we're doing. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you next Tuesday on a brand new episode of Erica Taught Me.